And we're going behind the door again when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, so far, nobody has slammed the door shut. We'll open up this one, see who's back there. Hello there.
Welcome,
how are you?
George. Hi there.
Now, this one is going to be tough for me.
Well, you're going to have a hard time figuring out who I am because I am not trackable.
Not trackable. Catherine Albrecht.
You got it. Hey, George. How you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I am fantastic.
Still working on those RFID tags?
Yes, we are, and we're trying to keep those tags off of everybody, so you won't know who's behind any of those doors unless you open them up.
Well, I hope you continue, Catherine, because they are doing all they can to get people chipped, aren't they?
It's coming at us from every side. I tell you, just this week alone, we've had a couple of big announcements. You know, I've been saying for years, and you know this, and your listeners know this, that I've been warning people, if we go forward with this RFID microchip tracking technology, eventually the government's going to want to use it to track us. And they've said, no, we'd never do that. And guess what? They're starting to say it. We're actually in the state of Washington now. They're now introducing the first, what they're saying may be the Real ID compliant driver's license, and it actually has an RFID chip in it. Now, it's optional so far. You can choose to have one if you want to simplify your crossing over the border into Canada or, across state lines.
Mm-hmm.
But it's starting to look a little bit hairy when you actually see driver's licenses with RFID tags in them.
Now, what's going on with the National ID program?
Well, this is the Real ID Act, and there is huge opposition to this. And for people who aren't familiar with what's happening, this passed a while back as part of a military appropriations bill, and they slipped a little tiny bit of wording in there. Actually, it wasn't so tiny, but it was hard to vote against, saying that all of our driver's licenses would be put under the control of the Department of Homeland Security and standardized, federalized, and centralized. And what that means is essentially, to people who are paying attention, is the creation of a national ID card. And even more worrisome still, the folks at Homeland Security are the very people who have been sending all these contracts towards all of these big RFID pushing companies, and they have come out and said that they think it might be a good idea to put RFID in our driver's licenses. So this, if we allow this to go forward, if we allow our driver's licenses to be federalized under Homeland Security, it gives them the ability to impose whatever requirements they want on their biometrics, RFID, you name it, they can do it. Now, the good news is that there's huge opposition to this. Already four states have voted to reject it, and that's Arkansas, Idaho, Maine, and Washington. Dozens more, including my home state here of New Hampshire, already have bills in the works to try to try to kill it, and there's talk about overturning it in Congress. So, but we need all the help we can get.
Catherine, in your opinion, what's wrong with a national ID card?
Well, I think the problem here, George, there are multiple problems. Anybody who's concerned about identity theft, the idea of centralizing all of our information to where access to one central point could potentially give you access to all the individual information. You look at the state of California, for example, and they have multiple times had to fire all of their Department of Motor Vehicle employees because they were caught grabbing people's identification right out of the computer system and then selling it to identity thieves. And creating fake licenses for them. Well, the good news for us in New Hampshire is they couldn't get a hold of our information. They couldn't get a hold of information in Arkansas or Florida or anywhere else. But if you set up this centralized database type system where anyone can access that information, it puts us at risk for that. Now that's on the more practical front. But if you look at the liberty issue, the idea of a national ID card really conjures up images of jackbooted thugs saying, your papers, please, where you can't even, cross state lines or even drive down the street in your car without the risk of somebody stopping you and, roughing you up and looking over your papers. So I think that's probably the bigger issue. We're not the kind of a country, George, that wants that sort of federalized control over our movements and our identity. And I think that's probably the biggest concern. And it really strikes a deep chord for a lot of people. And for me, because of the research that I do into RFID and microchips and implants, I start saying, well, now, wait a minute. So we're going to centralize the driver's licenses. Then we're going to put RFID tracking devices in them. And now, wait a minute. So that I could lose my RFID-based driver's license. And if it's really tracking me that you're after, then the next step is going to be an RFID implant. I mean, that's really the end point of this if we don't...
Yeah, it's the implant that really bothers you, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I got to tell you, I got to give you a little preview here. We have some huge breaking news on this implant that I think is going to turn the tide and put a big crimp in their implant plants.
Oh,
so
really?
I'm just going to tease you a little bit. But I'll give Coast to Coast listeners the first scoop on that when we're ready to reveal it next week. But we've got a big breaking story that's going
to. So you're going to break that on Coast to Coast?
We will break that on. I'll promise you that, George. I'll do it right here on Coast to Coast.
All right, we will do that, and I'm looking forward to it. And are you saying, Catherine, we may be winning the battle of the chips?
Well, we're losing on the government front because we need more people to be aware. You know, how many people hearing this conversation tonight don't even know that there is a real ID Act or that those of us down in the trenches working on privacy and civil liberties have been fighting this thing tooth and nail? I'm guessing most people probably don't know. And that's the place where we're not winning because, you know, I mean, you have the guts and the courage to break these stories, but a lot of the mainstream media out there is just not going to touch it with a 10-foot pole because what the government wants, the government typically tends to get when you're dealing with mainstream media. And they don't want this controversy, you know, brought to the awareness of the public. So we're putting up on our website, and if I could give that out, it's spychips.com. I know many of your listeners are already subscribers to our free newsletter and get all of our press releases. But we're going to put some information up there of where people can go. There's a comment period open to the Department of Homeland Security until May 8th. People can go in there and write, hey, I don't want this real ID. I don't want a national ID. We'll put a couple of links up there of where people can find some instructions on how to file those. And you know who's doing good work on this, George? The ACLU. They've actually put up a web page. They've got a whole section in there on religious opposition to real ID.
Are actually some things they tackle that they do a good job on. There's some other things they do that just make me cringe. For example, when they go after nativity scenes and things like that, let's say City Hall puts a nativity scene in their front. The ACLU's gone after them for that.
Well, I'm with you. I think that's appalling, and that's why I was really pleased when I went. They've got a website up called realnightmare.org, which is instead of real ID, it's realnightmare.org. But up there, they've actually got a whole section about religious opposition, and they talk about how people are concerned that this could be the precursor to the mark of the beast. Of course, the good folks at End Time Ministries have been talking about that. I believe been on your program, and you know, so they've actually they're really defending, I think, even you know, the rights of Christians to say we don't want this national ID card. We don't want these RFID tags and such. And on their realnightmare.org website, they've got a little action center where people can go on, and they've got a map, and people can click up their own state and actually see if the lawmakers in their state are working on this and what they can do to get involved and let them know, hey, you know, pull my state out of this. We don't want to be part of it.
Catherine, how did you get involved in this battle? What happened?
Oh, boy. Well, the real ID battle or the whole thing?
I guess the real ID battle, maybe the whole thing.
Well, you know, I came to this whole issue basically as a Bible believing Christian, and you know, I've got a doctorate from Harvard University. I'm a researcher. I'm an academic, but I'm also a Christian. And you know, at the age of 9 years old, as I've told on this program before, actually at the age of 8 years old, my grandmother warned me that there would be a time when people would not be able to buy or sell unless they had a number or a mark on their right hand or their forehead. And of course, that's the mark of the beast. And at the age of 8, I said, well, you know, that seems pretty far-fetched, but if it ever happens, I'm going to sit down and sit up straight and pull out my Bible and pay attention. And I got to tell you, George, back in 1999, the mobile speed pass, remember the little wave and go? I thought, now, wait a minute, that's paying with a number, and that device could easily wind up on a wristwatch, and the next thing you know, it's going to wind up in an implant. And so I started paying attention. And the first thing I noticed was that we were already getting conditioned to IDing ourselves at the cash register through those frequent shopper cards, and that's when I put up our website at nocards.org. In fact, I wound up writing my dissertation at Harvard on that topic. So I got very interested in this whole thing about how do we buy and sell in this country, and how is that shifting towards buying and selling with a number? And of course now, I mean, you go to the supermarket and everybody's using a credit card or typing in their little PIN number. So you're not seeing cash as much. You have people now talking about eliminating cash altogether. you know, which of course is going to be a necessary condition for paying with numbers only. And then you see the development of these very sophisticated sort of ID-based purchase systems, you know, where when you scan that frequent shopper card at the grocery store, you're not just handing over, you know, a discount card. You're actually participating in a very complex network of high-speed computers that are all interconnected. And all your data, including every roll of toilet paper and every gallon of orange juice that you buy, goes right in that database.
Even though you are getting a little discount on some of the items there that you buy.
Well, I got to tell you, even that, we did some research and we found out that even that was bogus. We found we looked at the prices before and after, they raised the prices and then lowered them back to higher than what they were before with your card. I'll give you an example.
Velveeta, so it gives you the impression. Right?
Yeah, Velveeta cheese actually said right on it, every day, you know, the manufacturer's suggested retail price of $3.99. And the day after they introduced this card at an Albertson store in Waco, Texas, they said everyday low price $5.99, but with your card you can get it a $2 discount and get it for $3.99. Well, it said right on the package that Kraft was charging $3.99. So, you know, that's how you get people to sign up. You coercively charge them higher prices, and then you twist their arm until you get them to do what you want them to do.
Well, Catherine, again, what can people do first and foremost to jump on board and fight these things?
Well, I'd say the key thing, we are keeping track of what's happening with Real ID, RFID, chip implants, and all of that on our website at spychips.com. Of course, many of your listeners have bought our book, Spy Chips, and already are up to speed on what's going on with the RFID issue. We combed, my co-author Liz McIntyre and I, who's also been on this program,
Yes. We
combed through about 30,000 different documents to paint a very convincing and thorough picture of what the RFID future is going to look like. And, of course, I'm a Harvard researcher. She's a former federal bank examiner, so you don't get better credentials than that to expose this stuff. Everything's footnoted and proven, so if you want to tell your brother-in-law or that lady across the water cooler at work who looks at you like you're nuts when you say, hey, we better wake up and pay attention, just hand him a copy of the book. That ought to set him straight. And the ACLU, their website is realnightmare.org, and then we're going to post some other information on our website at spychips.com that'll help people figure out where they can go to post those comments to the Department of Homeland Security.
I guess you would also be opposed to the chipping of pets.
Oh, you better believe it, George. I am, you know, because what message does that send to us? If you say, well, gosh, if you love Fido or Fluffy, then you would chip Fido or Fluffy. And once we get a whole generation growing up believing that that's the way you show love is by putting it, embedding a microchip in someone's flesh, then the next step is going to be to say, well, you know, if you love Junior, then when he's bored in the hospital, you ought to just slip a chip right under his, you know, collarbone. So, yeah, I think that when you start setting that precedent, especially for young people, and, you know, young people really love their dogs and cats, you know, you can find your animal again if you just put a collar on them. We don't need microchips. But if you associate that with love and safety and security, then you're just priming the pump for when that next generation comes along and you want to put it in children. And they say, well, gosh, yeah, I guess that would be a demonstration of how much I love my kids. Yeah,
absolutely.
And
you
it's
know,
a
you
dangerous,
can
it's
put that collar
stuff.
With that little metal ID tag on them, on their neck, and let it dangle. They'll be fine. It doesn't fall off if you clasp it right to the dog collar, huh?
Well, and, you know, we've been using it. We've been using collars for years. And now, all of a sudden, there's this whole push to microchips. And believe me, after we talk next week, when I break this story, if you've got your dog microchip, you may even want to go to the vet and get it removed. And I'll tease you with that little bit
okay.
of that.
Okay, that's good. You know, maybe we're just too sophisticated these days, huh?
Well, doesn't it seem like the technology pushers are trying to find really complicated solutions for
with
really
everything.
Easy problems?
Yeah. I mean, no matter where you look, Catherine, no matter where you look, they're making life complicated. They're making things too technical. I kind of miss the old days sometimes.
Boy, me too. You know, I got rid of my answering machine for that reason. I hated coming home and there'd be 15 messages and there'd be a half hour, you know, or an hour out of my day of just returning the calls. And I finally said, you know what, I actually remember when the first answering, when I heard my first answering machine, and I remember before that, and I thought, gosh, what if I could just go back to that and not incur all these obligations when I'm really, you know, when I'm doing nothing, I come home
well,
and
I'm you know what's funny? I love my cell phone. I do a lot of work with it. It's become my portable office. However, before I had one years ago, I got by. I functioned. I still did my thing. I still communicated with my coworkers. I did what I needed to do. Isn't it amazing?
Amen. I tell you. And the more complicated we make things, the more dependent we become on these technologies. And, you know, as Thoreau said, we become the tools of our tools.
We're also a texting society. Everybody who has these cell phones now, younger than older, everybody's texting each other now. Sometimes when they're driving in the car.
Yeah, that's probably not so smart. Yeah. This technology, when you look at RFID, and we haven't talked about that for a while, but when you look at the idea of embedding computer technology into every physical object that you own, and you know the pushers of this, the people who develop it, they look forward to the day when objects will talk to one another. That's the way they put it. So they actually envision it won't just be texting on your computer, but the belongings in your home, they envision them texting to one another. I mean, this whole world of just, you know, it's like being on the inside of a computer. And most people say, enough is enough. I don't want the computer. I don't want to be in the computer. And I certainly don't want the computer to be in me. So keep those implants at bay.
Is there a political push to get chips embedded in us because of money? Or is it because Big Brother just wants to know where we are?
I think it's a little bit of both. There's definitely huge money to be made. If these companies are lobbying the government to push RFID in any possible way they can. Because imagine if you landed the contract to put an RFID tag into every American's driver's license, how lucrative that would be. So these companies are relentless. I mean, they send just, vultures swooping down on Congress as lobbyists promoting this technology. So there's big bucks in that. And on the Big Brother side, yeah, obviously, you know, the more corrupt a government becomes, the more closely it feels it needs to watch its citizens because it's got to watch its back. When people are behaving in a corrupt way, when they're lying and cheating, when they are, the more corrupt they become, the more paranoid they become because they know if they're not watching and controlling everybody else, everybody else is going to throw the bums out.
Well, that is so true. Then you also got to find out who are some of the people behind these companies getting these deals. You got to watch that, too.
Well, and now we're starting to see a lot of overlap between the private sector and the government. You know, Tommy Thompson, former Secretary of Health and Human Services, mm-hmm. who was in charge of the FDA, at the time they approved the VeriChip as a medical implant, I might add, left his Bush cabinet position and took a job on the board of directors at VeriChip.
Did he not say he was going to get chipped? And I don't know if he ever did or not.
He never did, and God bless him. I'm glad he wised up and decided not to do it. Of course, he wants the rest of us to get chipped.
But he never
rolled up his own sleeve.
He told everybody he was going to. He hasn't told everybody he didn't, right?
No, he is not. And in fact, his latest move, because he's running for president.
Yeah,
and I'll tell you, it's a huge liability politically to be sitting on the board of directors of the implant company. So he stepped down a couple weeks ago. He actually said, I'm too busy with my campaign.
That's because you probably were going to publicize it and ruin his campaign.
Oh, you got it. Oh, can you imagine he's up on stage and you're debating him and you say, well, now my opponent here, Mr. Thompson, of course, believes that all Americans should have a chip implant.
Yeah.
I mean, it's political suicide.
Oh, it is. You're gone right there.
Absolutely.
And then if you have a chip, people will say that you're a Manchurian candidate.
Well, oh, that's a good one. I like that. I'm going to borrow that one, George.
You can use that because that could happen too. Well, Catherine, give us the websites again.
Okay, website. Our website, of course, is spychips.com. We've got a free newsletter. We now have over 15,000 members across the U.S., thanks in large part to Coast members who've signed up. We are putting together different activities in different states, most recently in Florida and in North Carolina. So if you're in either of those states, please hop on our website at spychips.com and sign up. Give us your contact information, and I will have somebody get in touch with you. We're actually planning some protests in those states. And as far as Real ID goes, you can go online to realnightmare.org, which is the ACLU's website. I know a lot of people are uncomfortable with the ACLU, but I'm real pleased with what they're doing on Real ID. And once you get on their website at realnightmare.org, click on Action Center. It'll bring up a map, and then click on your home state, and it'll tell you what you can do to be involved. And then the final thing you can do on Real ID to slow down this national ID or actually stop it is go on our website, and we're going to put some information. I'm not sure if it's up there yet. Our webmaster's working on it. But we're going to put up information with a link to another organization called Privacy Activism that'll tell you how to file comments with Homeland Security to tell them to knock this stuff off.
Great. Catherine, thanks so much. And you're going to break the story when? When's it going to come out?
Next week. Next week. And be on the edge of your seats, because I'll tell you, this is going to blow your socks off.
You got it. And we're going to find out soon who's behind the next secret door. Hey, Linda Bolton Howe tomorrow will be with us for a couple of hours. She's at a UFO conference and will bring us some great guests live. And then we'll have 2 hours of Friday the 13th open line. So get ready for that. Hey, by the way, Gerald Celente, and I'm getting some fast blasting emails. Gerald Celente said that Bill Clinton at the time signed NAFTA into law. Some of you are sending me emails saying, no, that's not true. That George Bush Sr. signed it into law. No, that's not true. Gerald Celente is correct. Bill Clinton did sign NAFTA into law. George Bush Sr. signed the agreement and then left office, but Bill Clinton signed it into law. So they both signed it. One signed the agreement, the other signed it into law. I love this format. Let's go now to the secret door and see what may be back there, who may be back there. Hi there.
Some enchanted evening, you will hear a stranger. You will hear a stranger across a crowded bandwidth.
I love the voice, and I know the voice, but I don't remember this person singing. So I'm going to ask a little bit more, and then I'll make my guess who this may be. Have you been on Coast to Coast a lot?
Yes.
John Hogue. There it is. Great voice, John.
I used to be an opera singer, you know.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, long ago. I was what you might call a child prodigy of opera singing. I was like 21 years old. It's an old man sport, so.
Why did you get out of it?
Oh, I got tired of the politics. And also, I really was pulled to do my own creating. And it was wonderful. 6 years I was in it. It was, I learned a lot of things. I had a wonderful couple teachers and mentors, Bill and Irene Chapman, who, in a way, with their approach to vocal lessons, which was the technique that allowed me to kind of be a singer actor. That is, I wasn't one of those people standing in costume like a post, because the technique I had was allowed me to move around and act, and it was a lot of fun. But I was starting to get pulled towards more kind of introspective, meditative things, and with that, shortly after that, I went off to India and started traveling around the world and going to ashrams and seeing amazing people. And then, after a long hiatus of that, came back and started writing.
Well, you know, good for you. I mean, do you sometimes sing karaoke or anything like that?
Well, I do a lot of a cappella, and sometimes I sing. I sing around town here, and you know, people have heard me singing around here, and in the little town where I live, I get dressed up sometimes for the whale festival, which is happening because we have gray whales that come by the town, and I get dressed up as the king of whales.
I love it. Well, to those new listeners, John Hogue is an expert on Nostradamus, and you've written how many books now, John?
Well, the ones in print are in paper are 10. Just last February wrote my 11th, which is an electronic book, and right now I'm up to my third eyeball in writing a second ebook, which I hopefully will have out by the end of May.
Good for you. And of course, the prophecies of Nostradamus, one of our favorites. You were on with us in February of this year. So only a few months ago, have some of the things we've talked about already reached fruition?
Oh, yes. We are now definitely in that two-year crossover point that we spoke of in the last show. It's sort of like the cusp in time between two ages. A lot of people are rather fixated on the 2012 phenomenon, but really there's all kinds of cycles coming to an end and recycling and beginning again in the next 30 years. The the one that is of, I think, specific intensity for our times is the one that kind of happens around the normal years of 2007, 2008. And, you know, some of the things even today that have happened, you notice that just the intensity level has gotten much higher. The things that are happening, things coming out that for the whole country to start looking at, for instance, the things that happened with IMUS and the college students. That's something I think we talked about is going to happen more and more. Things that have been under a lid and suppressed are going to hatch out. And of course, what will be important then when that starts happening, because we're entering revolutionary times. It starts a little now, and then by the end of 2008, we are actually entering, in astrological terms, a transit of Pluto and Capricorn, which has not happened since the late 18th century, the 1700s, when we had the Age of Enlightenment and Rousseau and a new way of thinking about economy, religion, sociality, and we had the Declaration of Independence, the American Revolution, and all of that enlightenment that came from that, and also we had the French Revolution. So the potential for revolutionary times being bloody or enlightening is come back to us again, starting at the end of, well, a month, a little less than a month after the next political presidential elections.
Nostradamus predictions or John Hogue predictions?
No, these are looking, you know, I'm probably best known for my Nostradamus work, but actually, there is a bit of Nostradamus in that, in his Jupiter-Mars conjunction prophecy, which he talks about, let's see if I can find it here. He talks about a very important confluence in the stars that doesn't happen very often, happened back in 2002. It's actually, the strange thing is, happened a few times in a cluster in this first decade of the new century. It happens again, I believe, right shortly around the inauguration day of the next president. And it basically, to paraphrase it, it talks about a new leadership that would come that could bring peace on Earth for a long time. But it comes after a ruinous war, a calamitous war under Cancer. And with that, to decode that, that means a country that's ruled by the sign of Cancer. What we have in America, July 4th, is born a Cancer. The president that is leading that country is also born under the sign of Cancer. So I've been often saying, actually I was even saying it 2 years before the war happened in Iraq, that there was a high chance because of this astrology that this president would get us sometime in the middle of his first term into a major war in the Middle East, which would become the second Vietnam. And, I mean, you know, people can check me out on what I said with all the stuff that's documented on my website, because I try to document everything I've said, especially in the archives of the Hogue Prophecy Bulletins, which I release every week for free. And you can see that right now, actually, I'm having a series called Between a Rock and a Hard Place, which is a look at everything I said since 2 years before the war up to the present and assessing what happened and what didn't. Unfortunately, most of it has happened.
4 years already, John. Can you believe that?
Yeah.
I've been there.
And what's also kind of a strange one for me is back on the 30th of October in New York, I was on The View with all the gals.
I heard about that.
Yeah, and I told them at a time when people thought it was impossible, I said Hillary Clinton's not only going to win the senatorial election, but in 2008 she will be a president of the United States.
And people, and you're going to stick with that, aren't you?
Oh yeah, I feel more confident about it than ever before. Now you know, I make presidential predictions, and I've been making them since 1968, and I'm 10-0 still. And they are based on the popular vote. That's why I wasn't wrong about Gore being picked president by the popular vote.
Right.
My sense now is, though I'll make an absolute confirmation, I usually make the final confirmation a year before. I do a bulletin like I did with George Bush's election back in early December 2000, 2003, I said, no, Bush is going to win the presidency, and I will probably have to do that sooner because the front runners will pretty much have sewed it up before even February, I think.
All right, give me, if you can, John, nominees. Obviously, then you're saying for the Democrats, Hillary's going to get it because you believe she's going to win the presidency. What about on the Republican side? Who's going to run against her?
Rudolph Giuliani.
Giuliani will. Okay.
Yeah,
well.
New Yorker versus New Yorker, in a way.
What about Obama? Seems to be squeezing ahead a little bit, though.
Yeah, he is. But I posted a bulletin with another twist of phrase called the Obama Nation, which looked at the destiny of Barack Obama. And what I sense with it is that he's definitely got the potential to be a president, but not in 2008. He's sort of like Kennedy was. He's kind of we talk often about on the show about the karmic echo that in history that America is in, how there's a lot of things that happened exactly 40 years ago that seem to be kind of upside down and repeated.
Right.
Like a musical theme turned upside down. You had a Texas Democrat president in a quagmire in Vietnam. 40 years later, you have a Texan Republican president in a quagmire in Iraq. And, for instance, I look at Obama as one of those potential Kennedy figures, which makes sense in the karmic echo that in John F. Kennedy's administration was the beginning of the rise of Martin Luther King's civil rights movement. And it makes only sense to me that 40 years later, you would have a man who would embrace many Kennedy-esque feelings and visions, who is a black man. It kind of says that we did that one right in the karmic echo, a good karma. Now, the thing that is critically important for Barack Obama and his weakness is his inexperience. He is as inexperienced now as Kennedy was in 1956 when he ran attempted to run as vice president for Adlai Stevenson against Eisenhower. He made an amazing speech, just like Barack Obama early in his senatorial career did.
And that put him on the map, right?
Yeah. And then another 4 years later, he was ready. I think what will be handed to him is an offer, and if he takes it, he will be a president in the future. If he doesn't take it, he will be, again, once a senator, never a president.
VP?
Yes. He's going to be offered, if he has not already been offered, the vice presidency in a Clinton ticket. And if he takes it, he, in 1 to 2 terms, will be a president. If he denies it, he will never be president.
Interesting.
And the thing is that he could be president sooner than the second term. He could end up being a karmic echo for Gerald Ford, because Hillary Clinton's presidency, if it happens, has a very strong karmic parallel to her being the Democrat Richard Nixon.
Really?
Yeah. And if she, as we get closer to the elections, I'm going to be writing more bulletins about that and talking about that she is really has an opportunity to make right what Nixon did wrong, or to go into the same kind of paranoia and ruin her presidency. She has the potential of being great, and she's about as people have a problem with her about as much as exactly 40 years ago when the quote-unquote new Nixon showed up. And in the parallel with that, too, Nixon kind of represented in the discord of the 1968 and 67 the feeling of, remember the Eisenhower years, how things were nicer?
Mm-hmm.
Back 10 years ago.
I was too little then, but yeah.
Yeah, but 10 years ago I was on The View and other places saying, you know, that people say, well, how would anyone take Hillary Clinton as a president? Let alone that she's a woman, no one will take that. That's what people were saying 10 years ago. Now it doesn't look so out of hat. The thing is that she is also going to run on the political mythology that things were better during the Clinton era. Because I tell you, the next 18 months we're going to enter a crisis period that rivals, if not transcends, the crisis period that we were in 68, for a number of more reasons than just the war. And the other irony is that we have reached a point in history that we will not be able to leave Iraq now. It's an ironic thing to say, and certainly not coming from a personal view of mine, but simply from being a person who watches future history and sees how it reverberates in the past, repeated in the future. The time for us not to get into Iraq was the day before the invasion in 2003.
This is the old rock in a hard place.
Yes, and so in this series, which has, you can see the last, I'm halfway through the series, you can see it posted in HogueProphecy.com, what's coming already, and I just actually, a few minutes before getting on the radio here, finished off the next installment. And we'll look at that and also look at what things can happen in prophecy that indicate how they can fix it. It will eventually get fixed, but it's going to take a decade. And one of the things that are going to happen is that the reason why we can't get out of there is, unlike Vietnam, there is the oil. And, I've been saying this since October of 2000, that this war that's coming is an oil war, and a lot. If you want to watch the conflicts of the next great global war, just watch the theaters where oil or gas is hidden underneath the ground.
Well, what's going to be funny too, John, is to watch the difference between our government and the Iraqi government, because the Iraqi government apparently wants to award some of these oil contracts to China and some other countries. And we're way down on the back burner. I'm not sure we're going to allow that to happen.
Well, yeah, and it's one of the things I came across, one of my favorite mystics, Osho, made an amazing statement that just blew me away. And it's just one of those simple, obvious statements that he said that if somebody, he said that a free man who chooses prison is free. But a person who is given freedom, who never asked for it, is still a slave.
So true. Real quickly, minute left. Hurricane season this year.
Oh, batten down the hatches. I'm definitely, I made the prediction about New Orleans several years before it happened, and Miami was also part of that prediction. I'm concerned for Miami and the Atlantic coast more this time around than I am the Gulf. So, be watchful. This one's going to be a doozy, and it might start a little early, too.
Well, okay, let's keep our eyes on the prophecies of John Hogue, who's predicting a Hillary Clinton nomination and presidential victory over Rudolph Giuliani. Where does Romney fit in on the Republican side? VP, possibly?
Yes, but I don't see it. I just don't see him going anywhere. In this, there is still also probably one of the more effective people that could be president would be Jeb Bush, but I think the name Bush will be so reviled and such a hot potato politically that even a qualified man like Bush's younger brother would be a very good choice for president. Is not going to be given the chance this time around.
Very good. John Hogue, thank you for coming in from the secret door.
I'll just sing off now.
Okay, thanks. Appreciate it. For Wayne Roberts, Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Ross Mitchell, Alan Corbett, Stephanie Smith, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.